Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, Alyssa Rosenberg will be on to talk about sex, contraception, and pop culture. President Obama causes right-wing media to lose their minds. And is it wise to ban wrongful birth lawsuits? I'm going to be talking about the right-wing response to Obama's announcement that he favors same-sex marriage for the first segment, but in a warm-up, I have to point out that a lot of conservatives evaded the question of gay marriage altogether and just claimed that this was naked political maneuvering. John Stewart responded.
And this is the true measure of how far we've come as a nation. In like 5 years, the prime talking point from Republicans about people who support gay marriage has gone from, it will destroy society via turtle to, oh, of course you're for it. You'll say anything popular to get reelected.
I still find it amusing that so many right-wing pundits hold it as an article of faith that Obama is committing a grievous sin by actually conducting a campaign. By far, the most common complaint about him is that he takes measures to appeal to voters. Why do they think that he and he alone doesn't have a right to actually campaign when he's campaigning? I think we can all take a shot and get pretty close to the truth of that. So, President Obama came out in favor of same-sex marriage. You may have heard. It's a pretty big deal, even though there's no real policy implications right now. The administration was already doing as much as they really could with the power that they have, so this was more of a president showing a leadership moment. It also, as you can imagine, created a five-alarm fire of fury in the right-wing media, all of which I rounded up so you don't have to sit through talk radio and Fox News yourself. Naturally, Rush Limbaugh responded as he usually does, with language that implies a personal, visceral sense that he's being physically assaulted. In Limbaugh's world, all sex ever is about assault and power, hurting others, being hurt yourself, and just dirtiness in general. That came across in his reaction.
They brought it up. We're sitting here, we're minding my own business, our own business. All of a sudden, they put gay marriage in our face for 3 or 4 straight days. I'm sorry, they're the ones that have introduced social issues. And it's perfectly understandable, then, isn't it, why they want us to shut up.
To paraphrase John Stewart, does Rush think that he has to get gay married? This putting it in our face language is really common amongst people who want to say homophobic things but not get called out on it. The argument behind it is that their bigotry is only a problem if they actually say something about it. And by demanding rights, gays are forcing them to say something about it, therefore it's somehow gays' fault that they're bigots. Of course, the actual reality is that bigotry, whether quiet or loud, is not acceptable. If you don't like people thinking you're a bigot, don't be a bigot. That you can be provoked to say and do bigoted things is your fault, not the fault of people who just want their rights. Believe me, Rush, having to acknowledge that gay people are human beings is not an assault on you. Not being allowed to visit your partner of 30 years in the hospital because you're not legally married is. Of course, then you had the right-wingers who decided that Bible-thumping was the appropriate response. Mike Huckabee was right in there, arguing that the 21st century politics should be determined by myths created by people thousands of years ago before they had science, democracy, medicine, or literacy. Huckabee took umbrage to the claim that opponents of gay marriage are on the wrong side of history.
I think history starts with Adam and Eve, and it goes through Sodom and Gomorrah, and the history of the Roman and the Greek empires. And a history is on the side of marriage, one man, one woman for life. More when we come back. This is the Mike Huckabee Show.
So, let's review. His evidence that history is against gay marriage is the creationist myth in the Bible that evolutionary theory has neatly disproved. And also, another biblical myth about mythological cities that there's no evidence existed, and which were supposedly destroyed by the wrath of angels. And his third piece of evidence is a vague reference to the Roman and Greek empires, neither of which had gay marriage, and both of which lasted longer than the American empire has so far. Okay. Here's the reality. The only argument he has is what he claims God believes, Well, this country has freedom of religion and separation of church and state. We don't have to make laws based on what Huckabee's God supposedly believes. Bill Donahue is busting out an even more illogical argument.
Nature has ordained, and nature's God, that only a man and a woman can have a family. Gay people have been disqualified from nature. Why would a society not take its social ordinance from nature? Why would we want to run against nature? Why not work with nature?
Arguments from nature are by far the most irritating logical fallacy, because it should be obvious why it's false, and yet people still go to this well. Bluntly put, there is no such thing as not natural or unnatural. We know gay people are natural for a very simple reason, which is that they exist. If something exists, it's in nature. If you want your law to reflect nature, then law has to reflect the reality that exists. And that reality is that gay people exist and they want to get married. Clay Aiken scolded noted homophobe Tony Perkins and basically summed up what I think of all this nonsense.
Back in the 70s, people made the same arguments against interracial relationships as they're making against same-sex marriages today. I really strongly believe that in the next 20 years, we're going to look back on this and be sort of ashamed of the fact that we were against this, just as we are ashamed today that we didn't let people of different races get married.
I think that's exactly right, which is why I see people taking a stand on this and I have to wonder about them. They have to know they're going to be seen as the villains of history, right? So why do they persist?
I'd like to welcome Alyssa Rosenberg to the program. Alyssa is the pop culture critic at Think Progress, and she brings a sharp eye to daily blogging about the intersection of progressive values and pop culture. She's here today so I can pick her brain about some topics of interest to RH RealityCast listeners. Welcome to RealityCast, Alyssa.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you're a big proponent of the theory that television and movies can have a widespread impact on people's beliefs and habits, and that should be harnessed as, you know, a source for good. Is there research backing up the idea that TV has this kind of influence on people's values and habits in this way?
Absolutely. I mean, there have been tons of studies over the years, of particular relevance given the influence that Vice President Joe Biden said Will and Grace had on his support for gay rights in general and marriage equality in particular. There's a new study out that talks about how, you know, depictions of gay characters sort of in the aggregate over time have had a role in shifting attitudes towards gay people. There are studies about, images of women in popular culture. There's a lot of evidence out there, and I think that one of the things that's been really interesting about, you know, sort of the culture war as we understand it, is that I think the right actually takes that evidence and the idea that culture has an impact much more seriously than the left does often. And so, you know, we see a lot of folks on the right, whether it's, you know, the Family Research Council getting hysterical over Glee or the Parents Television Council going after all sorts of, you know, minor slights to sort of shut down depictions on television, but we don't necessarily see creators, a lot of whom hold generally progressive values, taking advantage of their bully pulpits. It's really interesting to see a show like J.J. Abrams' Revolution, which will be on NBC this fall, which is sort of ostensibly about energy politics, but, you know, has a sort of totally nonsense, made-up science premise. You know, he has a huge platform. He could use it to say something useful about fossil fuels or global warming, but no, it's all energy on the planet has mysteriously ceased to exist or work. So I think people tend to give up their advantage sometimes.
And you actually, so usually when people talk about this, they're talking about depictions of like feminism or gay right or like gay people or racial minorities, but you did a really good post where you suggested that this kind of thinking could also apply towards contraception. If, like, TV could step up and help out a little with depictions of contraception. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons that I like Girls, Lena Dunham's HBO sitcom, a lot is because Dunham is very thoughtful about contraception. There's, you know, a subplot over the first three episodes that centers around whether she and Adam, the guy who is not precisely her boyfriend, but who she is definitely sleeping with, whether they consistently use condoms. When she gets diagnosed with HPV, Dunham took great care to make sure that all of the science involved in that subplot was accurate. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, it doesn't, she probably didn't have to do that. It may not register with everyone that the science is exactly accurate, but it's, you know, it's interesting to have a show that takes something like the fact that men can't be tested for HPV and makes it a plot point. And I think that actually sort of gets at the core of what I'm interested in. When people shy away from reality, I think just in general, they're often shying away from strong drama or, you know, sort of strong plot arcs. And in terms of contraception on television and movies, I actually think that it often is sort of unfortunate that people forego it in sex scenes, if only because I think it's kind of hot. It makes it seem more realistic that a couple is actually going to have sex, because most people who aren't trying to have children, you know, maybe take out a condom before they're going to have sex. And I actually think often, I think romantic comedies with black ensemble casts often do this really well. One of the really sort of notable examples of condom use that, you know, made an impression on me when I was young was this, the first sex scene in Love and Basketball, in Think Like a Man, which is out recently. Ramone Malka's character, like, clearly has condoms on him when he thinks he and Megan Good's character are going to get together for the first time. You know, I think it can actually add some frisson to a scene by making it seem like the couple is actually really having sex and thinking about all of the implications of it, instead of just, you know, violins and soft lighting. And, you know, there's a lot of sex in pop culture that doesn't look like sex.
Well, and it's interesting to me because reading your post, I thought about, like, is it possible that people underestimate how much other people are using contraception because of television? And recent research has come out suggesting that, in fact, 18 to 29-year-olds way underestimate how much pregnancy prevention is due to contraception. Do you think television has a role in those kind of misperceptions?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I think television propagates a lot of misconceptions about sex, right? I mean, one of the things that TV and movies, you know, suggest is that it's really weird if you haven't had sex for a while, or if you hit 19, haven't lost your virginity, you're some kind of freak. And so I think that, you know, TV can sort of produce anxieties or sort of expectations about what you're supposed to be doing. You know, and if sex is supposed to be about getting caught up in the heat of the moment, or, you know, or if a movie is giving you the impression that, like, you're not supposed to be thinking or acting rationally up to sex, I think that could give you, I think it's conceivable that it could give you the impression that you're doing it wrong.
Girls, obviously, is really blunt. They have explicit sex scenes. They're kind of a cringe comedy. They can be as explicit as they really want to be because it's on HBO. Do you think that there's a way that network TV could kind of be as responsible as Girls without crossing the censors?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's not obscene to, like, get an IUD or to take birth control pills. I mean, if anything, you know, it would be nice for me, you know, I would appreciate, for example, if almost every TV show about a woman has some scene at some point where she's going through her normal daily routine, you know, you get up, you brush your teeth, you get dressed. Is it inconceivable that someone would, like, pop a birth control pill before they brush their teeth? You know, I mean, that doesn't have to be explicit, but it could just sort of normalize use of oral contraceptives. You know, if you have the typical scene in a sitcom where a heroine or a hero pulls open a drawer and, like, looks through it for something, you can have condoms in there. I mean, I think a lot of this comes down to sort of, you know, set dressing and people actually thinking through the way that people go about their lives. It's like when you're learning improv for the first time and you're asked to sort of act out an action, or if you're miming something, you inevitably forget steps. And I feel like this sort of normalized placement of contraception, both, like, physically in people's rooms and its use in their daily lives, is almost like that skipped step in miming.
So, shifting gears a little, because I thought this was an interesting topic, the internet had a bit of back and forth on the question of another HBO show, Game of Thrones.
Ah, yeah.
And the sheer amount of sex in it. Can you kind of, just for those who haven't seen the show, like, it's almost it's more common than not that half of the scenes on the on any given episode have naked people in them. Or not sure. That bad, but can you kind of recap what you said about the debate over whether or not there was too much gratuitous sex on the show?
Absolutely. I mean, I guess I have real issues with the idea that, let me put it this way. I think Game of Thrones has tended to deploy nudity to make points in ways that often have payoffs later down the road. I mean, one of the big questions this year has been about the use of nudity in scenes set in a brothel owned by a prominent character in the show. And, you know, it's a brothel. People have sex there. And, you know, there have been a number of scenes where people have been spying on customers that, you know, have seemed to me more, yes, you end up seeing fairly explicit sex on scene, but you also, it's, those scenes are sort of a comment on prurience and spying, the act that sort of we're all doing when we watch naked characters on scene. But more to the point, you know, the characters, one of the younger prostitutes that we see naked a couple of times through the show ends up being the victim of a really brutal sexual assault. And the scenes that we saw her in ended up sort of building up her character so that when we did see her assaulted, we saw sort of all the things that she'd been taught and experienced before be sort of turned upside down and turned on her. And I actually found that fairly powerful. I also just think, you know, this is a setting in which people, grown-ups have a lot of sex under certain circumstances. If, you know, I've been reading Hilary Mantel's Bring Up the Bodies, her the second book in her cycle about Thomas Cromwell and Henry VIII, and, you know, the book is just obsessed with sex. If, you know, if Anne Boleyn is pregnant and Henry is worried about, you know, making her miscarry or disrupting the pregnancy, the courtiers are trying to figure out who's going to be a replacement mistress. You know, I mean, wow. This is a world. This is a story about a hereditary monarchy. You know, who has sex with who, and whether the children involved are legitimate. Whether, you know, how sex is an extension of power. I mean, all of these things seem like really relevant subjects to me. So I'm not, you know, I think there are. You know, I find something like Entourage, where, you know, you'll have a sequence where you see Vince, the main character, having sex with like six different girls in a row, where none of them are characters, and the only point that's being made is the point that we know before, which is that he's kind of a randy idiot. It's like, okay, I find that a lot more irritating than something like Game of Thrones, where, you know, sex is kind of a key to power.
Well, do you think that there's an argument for having sex as just blatantly gratuitous on TV, or do you think it really needs to be justified by the plot and characterization?
I mean, I think it... Let me put it this way. I think it needs to be something other than, hey, titties. Stars shows literally seem to have a, you know, quotient of naked breasts that are supposed to appear on screen per episode. I don't know if it's an official thing or not, but it certainly seems that way. And sometimes that nudity ends up undermining the character. Someone who's a serious candidate for the governorship of Illinois is not whatever TV writers might like to think, having quickies in like hotel lobbies because he gets excited about getting caught. You know, if there was something that, if the sex undermines characterization or sort of undermines plausibility, then I would be willing to call it gratuitous. Like, grown-ups have sex. There's, you know, I don't particularly have a problem with seeing that depicted on my television.
Awesome. Well, I think that's all we have really time for today, but thanks for taking a little time out of your day before your vacation to talk to me.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest today has been Alyssa Rosenberg, and you can follow her blogging at thinkprogress.org.
One of the weirdest parts about following the reproductive rights debate is watching all the increasingly baroque legal maneuverings of the anti-choice movement. The stuff they come up with in an attempt to take away women's basic rights to sexual and bodily autonomy is just astounding. NPR covered one such maneuver that's going on in a number of states.
Kansas and New Jersey are among the states debating so-called wrongful birth laws. They would prevent parents from suing a doctor who fails to warn about potential problems with an unborn fetus. These cases, while uncommon, are caught in the wider debate over abortion. Supporters call the legislation pro-life. Opponents say doctors would gain the right to withhold information so women do not have abortions.
It's such a small, weird thing to go after because it's a weird, small thing. Most doctors aren't anti-choice, and most doctors don't want to deprive their patients of important health information. These lawsuits are, as noted, rare. But this isn't really about the lawsuits themselves. It's about creating a legal infrastructure that undermines women's bodily autonomy. It's about making it legal for a third party to basically force you to have a baby you don't want. Once it's established in this case, I imagine they'll look for other ways to create legal precedent that brings an end to the idea that women own their bodies, at least while pregnant. By and large, any effort to keep people from seeking recourse in courts for injustice should be treated with skepticism. It's usually rooted in the idea that the people who might sue don't have basic rights. Carrie Ann Rinker of Kansas Now talked to NPR about this bill.
I believe it would allow them to lie about the results of an amniocentesis or simply opt out of even performing an amniocentesis that would normally be a part of standard care.
Rinker says it's important for parents to get all the information from their doctors so that in these tough cases, families can prepare for a child with a disability or make decisions about whether to have an abortion.
Forbidding somebody to seek recourse when they've been done wrong is basically saying that the wrong thing wasn't wrong. Anti-choicers are basically saying that the law should let doctors make the choice for women of whether or not to give birth, which means that they're trying to say that women's bodies belong to doctors and not themselves. Again, this is part of a larger attempt to create legal precedents that hold that all sorts of people, doctors, family members, husbands, conservative lawmakers, are the rightful owners of women's bodies, and not the women themselves. In the immediate future, there's very sad results that come about when families aren't given the opportunity to abort pregnancies that go very wrong.
In Suffern, New York, Sharon and Stephen Hoffman's son, Jake, was born with Tay-Sachs. It's a genetic disease that mainly affects Jewish families and is usually fatal by age 4 or 5.
There's no treatment. There's no cure. There's nothing.
Sharon says her doctor did not test for the disease. At 6 months, Jake was diagnosed with it, and the couple says he lost control of his muscles. He had constant seizures. Jake died 2 years later before reaching his third birthday. Sharon says she would have had an abortion if she had known.
A horrible tragedy could have been minimized or averted, depending on how you look at it. Either way, it's a far better option than forcing the child and the parents to go through this horror. For no real reason, except to create a legal infrastructure that holds that women aren't really people. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. Yes, it's all about punishing female sexuality edition. Republican state legislator Bubba Carpenter has words for those who point out that women who don't have access to safe legal abortion in Mississippi will just use coat hangers.
And of course, there you have the other side. They're like, well, the poor, pitiful women that can't afford to go out of state are just going to start doing them at home with a coat hanger. That's what we heard over and over and over. But hey, you have to have more values. You have to start somewhere. And that's what we decided to do. This bill came along.
Doesn't get more blunt than that. He shrugs off women dying and being dismembered because it's all about moral values. Death and injury is just what women have coming if they're supposedly immoral enough to have sex for reasons other than procreation. That's anti-choice morality for you folks.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.